architecture is about managing complexity, and generally we, as a profession, we are highly conscious of the role we play in terms of finding clarity and giving form to very complex problems and uses and responding to communities and their needs and their quality of life. And the energy and sort of carbon cost of what we do is it's another element in that complex equation, but it's just something we have to embrace. It's absolutely critical. Being nature friendly kind of invites, you know, natural forces to start acting on your project. And, you know, for centuries it's been about keeping nature away, you know, decay and animals and bugs and plants away from architecture. And now we're trying to make architecture friendly to those, or at least in our practice as well. So it's a huge shift in consciousness, and also the push to preserve and retain buildings rather than rebuild.
Welcome to the 22nd episode of the podcast Architecture City Planning by the German Federal Chamber of Architects. My name is Kerstin Kuhnekert. I am the host of this show, and this is the fourth episode this year. You can listen to all the episodes on the website bak.de/podcast, or, of course, wherever podcasts are available, like Spotify, Deezer, Apple Music, Amazon Music, and so on. You can also subscribe to the podcast there to never miss an episode anymore. This current season explores the question of how the debate on sustainable living and construction will change our profession and the way we build. We claim that we are at a turning point, that a new era is beginning, because the profession and the tasks of planners are changing. What role will architects, interior designers, urban and landscape planners play in the future in the transformation of our built environment? And because nothing is more important than thinking outside the national box, we have international guests in each season. We already talked to Rainier de Graaf from Rotterdam, Dorte Mandrup from Copenhagen, and Odile Deck from Paris. Today, Alison Brooks from London is our guest. Alison Brooks is a native of Ontario, Canada. Her office, Alison Brooks Architects, short ABA, has developed an international reputation for design excellence in projects ranging from urban regeneration and public buildings for the arts to higher education and housing. Alison Brooks Architects is the only UK practice to have won the Rebus three most prestigious awards for architecture: the Stirling Prize, the Mansour Medal, and the Stephen Lawrence Prize, in addition to other numerous national and international awards. The office is designing major projects across the UK. For example, the Exeter College Cohen Quadrangle at Oxford University. For that, ABA received the Reba South Building of the Year in 2022, the Reba South Regional Award in 2022, and the Civic Trust Award in 2021. Another example is the Ely Court in the South Kilburn Estate from 2015. For that, ABA received the Reba National Award 2016 and was shortlisted at the RICS Award 2016 and finalist at the EU Mies van der Rohe Award 2017. These are only two of many examples, which you can find on the website alisonbrooksarchitects.com/projects. You will find the link in the show notes to this episode. Now let's start the conversation, which I had with Alison Brooks in her office in London. She came to London in 1988 and she founded her own office in 1996. My first question was, what major changes has London gone through since you've lived here?
London, in a way, completely transformed itself, I think, in the 34 years since I've been here. It felt kind of run down and a bit stuck in the past when we first arrived. Even central heating was rare in houses, and you still needed matches to survive, because you needed matches to turn on the stove and turn on the gas heater, and that was something I'd never encountered in my life in North America. But there was a kind of freedom here, and kind of many subcultures and many super interesting creative people working in the UK, and it was also a very welcoming place in terms of sort of inviting the world to come to live and work in London. Then there was the Labour government came into power, and there was the kind of renaissance of the UK during the 90s, early 2000s, and a kind of flowering of culture and a lot of investment and money flowing into the city, and massive transformation in terms of renovation and construction and new development, and that kind of flow of capital, you know, a lot of global capital flowing into London really transformed the city. And now, of course, it's a world city, one of the most desirable places in the world to live, but it does suffer from a lot of inflation, price inflation, property inflation, gentrification. It's very expensive for many people here, but I think at the same time, you can always find your place in London. If you stick it out long enough, London sort of lets you in eventually. It opens its arms and embraces you, but I think that doesn't really happen until you've been here for about 7 years.
And how did you start your office here?
Well, when I first came to London, it was also a recession, so many architectural practices were closing or moving to Germany, like Sauerbruch Hutton, who I applied for a job with. And it was actually Matthias Sauerbruch who recommended I approach Ron Arad to see if I could work with him on a competition, because Sauerbruch Hutton was moving to Berlin and Peter Wilson was moving to Germany, and all the practices that I was applying to work with were moving away. And so
Did you ever think about moving to Germany as well?
Well, I couldn't really, because you can't. I had a Commonwealth visa, so I could come to London to work for 2 years. That's what I thought, that I would work for 2 years and try to save money and then do a master's at Cambridge University. That was my plan, to study under Joseph Rickford. But after 2 years in London, I didn't have any money to go to do a master's at Cambridge. But I was in the midst of lots of super interesting work with Ron Arad, and I managed to stay in the country and worked with Ron for 7 years, and then decided it was time to set up my practice in 96.
Okay, and your own, alone, did I get it right?
Yes, on my own. I mean, the thing is that when I was working with Ron, really, I helped Ron form Ron Arad Associates. Like, we were design partners, and I was running the practice and employing everybody and delivering our projects. And so when I went sort of at the point where I thought I need to set up my own practice, I'd already been running a practice with Ron, and so I just thought, I have to do this on my own. And I kind of thought it was important because there's so few women who set up their practice on their own. And
Which year was that?
96.
96. Yeah. And how did you get work?
Amazingly, well, 1996, computers were still in their infancy. And I remember I had a Mac Classic, you know, the tiny Mac computers. And I wrote 2 letters on that Mac, and one of them was to a client, a potential client who I'd met when I was working with Ron. We didn't get any work from that client, but I followed up with this letter, and it was to a developer in Hamburg, actually, Arne Weber, who owned H.C. Hageman, the construction company and development company based in Hamburg. And he wanted to, by coincidence, was looking to build a hotel in Helgoland. And so when I wrote the letter to Arne Weber, just saying that I'd set up my practice and would be happy to work with them at some point, because I'd met them, 2 months later I had a phone call asking if I'd like to design the interior of this hotel in Helgoland. So that was really my first commission, like major project. And in the meantime, I did competitions. I was doing, sort of competitions, working from home, the spare bedroom, the usual situation with architects starting their practice.
Yeah. As you said, as female architects weren't that many, you decided also that it's important to have your own office and to do it. Let's talk about that, because of course female architects aren't a rare species, but somehow it seems like they are not really there, because they are not visible. In England it might be the same like in Germany. We have the problem that there are only 1% women having own offices with more than 10 employees. Do you know how it's here, the numbers?
I'm sure it's similar, yeah.
And I read in an article in the Süddeutsche Zeitung about 2018, the Biennale, where you have been on a demonstration with other female architects like Odile Deck, who has been a guest in this podcast as well, Anna Heringer, Toshiko Mori, and the protest was organized by Martha Thorne, dean of the EI School of Architecture and Design in Madrid, and part of the Pritzker Prize Committee. And the Pritzker Prize, as we know, is mostly for men. Did anything has gotten better since 2018?
I think it's getting better, definitely. There are more female architects who are producing major buildings. Also Jeannie Gang, Amanda Lovett, Dorte Mandrup. They're, you know, very slowly, gradually, female architects are making a mark and being commissioned to do major buildings. But it is very rare and very slow, because normally there are, you know, on any competition shortlist, there might be one female-led practice. Mostly it's all men. For example, the recent National Gallery competition in London, Annabelle Seldorf won it, which is amazing, but the other five architects on the shortlist were all men and white and based in London or educated at Cambridge, or, you know, it's very much a kind of club. And you have to really perform to break into that club and to really allow, or your work is really the way in. In my case, also, especially because I'm Canadian, I'm not English, I don't have the connections or the network from being educated here or even working in a conventional architectural practice before I set up Alison Brooks Architects. I was working with Ron Arad, and we were working, you know, somewhere between design and, you know, the design world and interiors, and I was pushing very hard to move into the world of architecture. But it isn't, you know, most architects work in some big architectural practice before they set up on their own. And so I kind of really came in from the outside when I set up my practice and just had to really focus on the work, just, you know, so most of my work is won through competitions. Yeah. So that's been my route.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that on your website. And I mean, it's also very expensive to spend time and energy in competitions.
It is very expensive. It's very inequitable as well. And I think it's a real problem in the UK, especially, that many institutions stage competitions and are sort of encouraged to stage competitions, which is great in terms of sort of furthering architectural culture and giving perhaps lesser known practices a chance to win. But the problem is they're not properly compensated. They are, it's a huge drain on the practices who participate to do that competition. And I think there's a general suppression of fees, of salaries, of, you know, the ability to be profitable and pay people well, because the way to win work is such an expensive proposition.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's also like only the club has access, the few maybe.
Yes. It's very, very rare that you hear of any architect receiving direct commission for any kind of project in the UK. Mm-hmm. There's always a two-stage competition or a single-stage competition. I think clients have become accustomed to having lots of ideas put forward by architects, more or less for nothing, from which they can choose. And then that's a luxury that they benefit from, that really our professional institutions should discourage. And I mean, in some places, like in Canada, that's not even permitted, that architects who are registered in there with their provincial bodies, they have all signed an accord where they don't produce design work for nothing, and that they will always ensure that their architects are properly paid for any design work. So,
wow, okay. In Germany, we argue that competitions guarantee quality, and that it's, if it's a fair and open process, it's to find the best design for the environment, yeah, for the spot.
And so I agree with that in principle. I do think architects do their best work. It's such an intense process, yeah, and it's very focused, and you really push yourself. And I do think you do your best work in the competition setting. The problem is just the cost, yeah, the cost and the ability of smaller practices to compete with larger practices who have greater resources. You know, that is a very tough equation. Yeah.
Mm. Maybe it should be changed what you have to deliver, that it's not everything.
Yes, that's another way of doing it. And I think in Germany they are quite good at limiting the number of CGIs, you know, the renderings, which are generally really, really expensive. But then the problem is there's a huge requirement for hundreds of drawings, all drawn, yeah, you know, CAD drawings at certain scales and certain, you know, everything's very prescriptive, but still a huge quantity, yeah, of work.
Yeah. Yeah. So that has to be adjusted. In Germany, the Federal Chamber of Architects is working on that, or the chambers. We have 16 chambers. How is it in England?
Well, there's the RIBA.
Yes.
And there are regional RIBA organizations, oh, yeah, institutions. But in a way, the RIBA doesn't get involved in sort of questions of fees or fee scales or things like that, which were sort of abolished in the Thatcher, yeah, in the Thatcher years. But one other point I think that's important to say about competitions, why I believe they're a good thing, is that once you've won the competition, the client has bought into that vision, and the selection committee or the client body who has selected your project, and that commitment to that vision really helps sort of fortify the process and protect the design and protect the integrity of the ideas through the very long journey that buildings or projects go through.
Yeah.
So I do actually support competitions in principle, but it's just the way they're run is something that I think feeds into the inequitable and the kind of discriminatory condition of practices of sort of contemporary UK practice sort of operations in a way, and it sort of, I think, maybe prevents female architects from sort of committing to, you know, founding their own practice, taking on that risk, and kind of, you know, surviving that that condition of practice, of larger practice, where you are competing with other large practices, which we do and which I do.
Yeah, but it's hard.
It's hard, but no great art is ever achieved without great suffering. I think it's true, and unfortunately, I think the client culture knows that. They know that architects will suffer for their art and, you know, go all the way. And in a way, our institutions should be protecting and defending our art and our culture from exploitation. And I think that's not really happening.
You're now talking from a perspective of the typical architect way, like thinking from the space, from the object, architecture as an object. How do you think the profession will change? Do you recognize something here already in London, in Britain, because of the climate change and the material problems?
Absolutely, the profession is changing. I think human culture is changing, or the consciousness, our collective consciousness is changing because of climate change, climate crisis, the health crisis, the race crisis, and now war. You know, a war that is tied to all of these other conditions of food supply and geopolitics and energy and fossil fuels. It's all connected, and I think architects are kind of at the front line of a lot of this thinking, because we care a lot about the environment, whether it's the built environment, increasingly the natural environment, and the cost of building to the natural environment wasn't really taken into account properly until really the last sort of 10 years, when there's been kind of legislation has really started to kick in to make sure that we build conscientiously, reducing our carbon footprint and being nature friendly, which is one of the hardest things to do, because being nature friendly kind of invites, you know, natural forces to start acting on your project. And, you know, for centuries it's been about keeping nature away, you know, decay and animals and bugs and plants away from architecture. And now we're trying to make architecture friendly to those, or at least in our practice as well. So it's a huge shift in consciousness, and also the push to preserve and retain buildings rather than rebuild. There's a huge resistance now to tearing buildings down in London in particular, but I think across the UK. And to understand the carbon, you know, the embodied carbon involved in demolition and reconstruction, also the operational carbon. But it's become a very sort of emotional debate that's not always accurate to the real carbon cost of either preserving a building, retaining it, or demolishing it and building anew, because sometimes retaining the building will be more damaging in terms of embodied carbon and operational carbon than tearing it down and building it new. But sort of politically and emotionally, people don't want to see buildings being torn down.
That's the first time I hear that. How's that possible? If you don't tear it down, that it costs more energy.
In terms of retaining an existing building, how can that be more carbon intensive? Because often you need to do a huge amount of work to that building to achieve the kind of spatial qualities, the air quality, the heating systems, insulating, fireproofing, dry lining, rewiring. You end up doing a huge amount of work, and often they take much longer in terms of the construction process. That's also energy intensive, and ultimately they don't perform better in terms of operational carbon. And so over the long term, renovated buildings often don't perform as well as a new build. So it's a very complex equation to calculate life cycle costs in terms of energy and carbon. And it's not black and white. It's not always the case that it's better to preserve the existing building, unless the program that you're putting in there, the uses are pretty much exactly the same as what they were before in terms of the spatial brief of the building. It's very difficult to take a building designed for something in the 1950s and completely change its use and expect it to be a low carbon proposition for the long-term future. Mm-hmm. And this is what our engineers are telling us. Our structural engineers and our mechanical and environmental engineers, they actually think that it's already sort of swung too far in terms of preserving existing buildings, that the numbers don't often demonstrate that that is the best decision, but politically it's kind of given priority regardless of the data and the numbers. Mm-hmm. So I think we're in our, as a culture, we're still at the very beginning of really understanding the cost to the environment of what we do in terms of energy, carbon, and sort of operations and how that all amortizes over the lifespan of the building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we want desperately easy solutions.
Yes, yeah. People want a kind of black and white response to these questions, and it's super complex. And in a way, I think architecture is about managing complexity. And generally, we, as a profession, we are highly conscious of the role we play in terms of finding clarity and giving form to very complex problems and uses and responding to communities and their needs and their quality of life. And the energy and sort of carbon cost of what we do is another element in that complex equation, but it's just something we have to embrace. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely critical.
Do you think about removing a house when you build it nowadays? I mean, because architects always build forever, but of course, architecture's always temporarily. What role does it play that you have to think about rebuilding it someday, maybe?
Yes, the sort of lifespan of the building, longevity, robustness. These are principles that I've been promoting for many years, really since I started my practice. The principle of building for the long term, building places or buildings that people really love, means they will be maintained, they will be looked after, and they will last longer. If you design something that's lifts people's spirits and is beautiful, and this is the kind of principle behind the idea of beauty that I advocate, or civicness. These qualities are things that help people to live a better life and feel better about themselves and about the world around them. And so that's, I think, the role that architecture can play in providing that sense of well-being, of value that people need, and also creating something that people will love and take care of for, you know, decades if not centuries. And that's the most sustainable way to build.
And is it difficult to build a cradle-to-cradle house, or does it play any role at all?
So by cradle to cradle, it's about the kind of circular life of buildings and the materials that we use. And we do talk a lot in and work very hard to make sure that the materials that we use in our projects and my projects are recyclable, and a lot of the buildings that I've produced have been clad in stone, for example, or in brick. And obviously those are earth-based materials that can be either reused in their original state or ground up and used as fill. You know, inevitably they will, or you hope that they will be recycled. Concrete frame is another sort of target for the activists, that concrete frame is always bad because of the energy and carbon footprint of concrete. But there are innovations in material science now, so there are concrete products that are earth friendly that are being made to eventually become net zero in terms of the also the cement content and the aggregates, 100% recycled or recyclable. So I think material technologies are advancing to ensure that we can in the future use concrete which performs best in terms of long-term climate change, of the heat that we're going to be suffering potentially in 50 years. You know, you need materials with thermal mass like concrete to combat overheating and to allow natural ventilation to actually work, like this building we're in now, which is concrete ceiling, concrete structure, concrete floors. It stays cool, temperate year-round, and no air conditioning, no mechanical systems.
And it stays long. I mean, it's old.
Yes, it's this building I'm in here with my office is about 170 years old, and I think it will last potentially for hundreds of years. And that is a kind of robust framework that can adapt. It's a warehouse. It also has very high ceilings. This is another element of architecture that is so basic, so simple as a principle, that has such a huge effect on the way people feel about where they live or where they work. And that kind of embedded generosity in proportions and robustness in materials, these are as important as the kind of carbon footprint of the material that you use. If it's performing for hundreds of years and it's helping people to be more healthy and more productive and feel like they're living a kind of worthwhile and beautiful life, that has immeasurable value. And I think the kind of immeasurable things in architecture are what everybody understands, but it's very hard to articulate and very hard to monetize. And in, you know, the contemporary world, anything that you can't put a numerical value to in terms of cost and money, it's very hard to fight for those things. But I think we're getting better at that slowly.
In Germany, we have a debate about wood versus concrete. And there are many people really saying concrete is the bad guy and wood is good, like it's the solution for everything. As you said, concrete has its advantages. How is the debate here? Are there also architects saying wood is the only solution or the best solution we have got? Is it increasing the wood buildings here in England as well?
The move towards building with mass timber has huge momentum behind it. I think many, many architects would love to be building in 100% mass timber. Unfortunately, the Grenfell fire, you know, the Grenfell Tower disaster,
yes,
where 76 people died in that building, that has completely changed the landscape in the UK in terms of combustible materials in construction.
The problem was the facade, no? It was,
yes,
not wood.
There was no wood in that building. But the principle of combustibility is something that the insurance industry has basically latched onto. Or the insurance industry now considers combustible materials absolutely forbidden in any building over 18 meters. in the facade, in the windows, in the pipework, anything related to the periphery of the building cannot be combustible. So that has been very unfortunate for timber architecture in the UK. And even in office buildings can be built with mass timber up to 18 meters. But beyond that, it's not that it's technically not possible, but the insurance industry won't insure those buildings. So it's become very difficult to build with that. And public perception, developers, especially with housing, they are very reluctant to use timber at all. So we hope that over time that, you know, it will prove that it's actually safe to work with mass timber. And as in Germany, Sweden, even North America now, they're building major buildings with timber. Interestingly, people don't really think about the other elements that go into timber buildings. All of the dry lining, the plasterboard, that has a huge carbon footprint. All the finishes, all the furniture. We tend to focus only on the structure and not think about all the other components of the building that have embodied carbon. The great thing about mass timber when it's exposed is that you enjoy the timber, the smell, the haptic qualities of it, but often it has to be covered up because of fireproofing. So again, it's a kind of evolving scenario in the UK, and people are starting to understand that actually concrete gives you the thermal mass, it gives you longevity, and with the material advances, it's becoming much lower in its embodied carbon. So it's no longer this binary, timber is good and concrete it's bad.
Yeah. But what if there's not enough sand anymore?
Well, there's a lot of recycling to do in terms of, you know, waste from construction is a huge problem. And I think that's the other part of the resistance to demolish is that so much construction waste goes into landfill. And so, but more and more now, the process of demolishing any building means being very precise about documenting what you're demolishing, preserving and recycling and sorting all the materials so they can be recycled or reused. So the, in a way, the science of building is now also the science of deconstructing and recycling. Yeah. And that's something we all have to take responsibility for.
And when you construct, you have to make a documentation maybe as well, which materials are inside that building for the time when it has to be deconstructed or no? Like in a BIM model, maybe, do you use the building information modeling?
Yes, we use BIM. And as BIM advances as well, I think it will become more sophisticated in terms of the sort of embedding the information about its life cycle and its recyclability. All of that data and all of those metrics will eventually inform all of our decisions. But I think at the moment, BIM is quite primitive. It's not, because you need manufacturers to supply all that data that gets embedded in the model. And then there's the relationship between different materials and how they work together. So again, that's another level of complexity. It's kind of like scientists or doctors involved in, you know, the human body. It's like this infinitely complex infrastructure, and the more you look and the more you embed information, the more you find. So yeah, it's kind of like a fractal as well.
But do you work interdisciplinary together with other, let's say, psychologists, socialists, whatever, material experts, to get the best result? In Germany, we debate about it, that it's important that different experts come together because of the transformation we are going through as a society. How is it here in the UK for architects? Is it still being iconic, more or less, or is that changing as well?
It's definitely not being iconic. Even the word iconic is kind of banished from the language of architecture in the UK. There's much more sensitivity to the context in which the project or the building is operating. And, you know, iconic architecture for the sake of the building is really seen as a kind of failure or a sort of like narcissism, unwanted narcissism from architects. So that doesn't really happen anymore.
It's a new way of thinking, no? I mean, when I look at London, there are many iconic buildings, and that makes the city special, of course. But it's like a new development, what you mean now?
Well, there came a point, I suppose, in the 90s when it was a little bit about the Bilbao effect, or the fact that cities could give themselves a new identity and kickstart their economy with an iconic piece of architecture. And, you know, this worked in the case of Bilbao, and it had its moment in terms of other cities. It's also recognition that cultural buildings actually can really help the economy of cities and really, yeah, transform perceptions, which is a good thing. But the sort of push to make every building an iconic statement was, I think, really misguided. It's not something that I've ever adhered to, because my work is very much about context. It's about understanding the culture of the place, the history of the place, the kind of undiscovered memory of a place, and creating something very specific that responds to that. So maybe sometimes you don't even notice the new building, and sometimes it actually distills the collective memory in a way that people really celebrate it and love it. But it's never about architecture for the sake of making a statement. So, yeah, and there's a lot of very quietly beautiful buildings that are being built in the UK today. Also in Germany and Netherlands. There's a, and I think generally in Europe there is now a tendency to do quietly beautiful architecture. Yeah. I think in North America there's still a tendency to do iconic architecture. There's still a desire for, you know, highly Instagrammable sort of spectacle buildings that sort of stand alone on their site and could be anywhere.
Yeah.
And I think that's unfortunate. Maybe it will change over time, but it's a kind of cultural condition, I suppose, where maybe it's about the principle of individuality, that they value the individual over the collective. And so every building has to be a kind of statement of individuality or modernity at the cost of everything else. Like, I'm going to be radically modern and just completely clash with everything that's come before. And I really question that approach, because I think also those kinds of projects become dated very quickly. Well, I shouldn't be. I shouldn't be really criticizing these things.
No, maybe it's just because it's too much. Every city wants something great, but maybe it's too many iconic buildings. But you are very much known as an architect who makes great design and very high quality dwellings. Are dwellings nowadays more discussed? Because also since Corona, we talk about the city and the quality of public space, and the importance of dwellings is now in the minds, I guess.
I hoped that COVID-19 and the sort of work from home situation we all found ourselves in would shift the kind of the benchmark in terms of how the development industry works in the UK or globally, because I think everybody really understood that the quality of space of your home is, you know, you understand its limitations. When you're working from home all day, you also understand the value of your street, your neighborhood, the nature around where you live or the lack of it. So all of these things became very much at the forefront of our consciousness. Even before that, I always promoted the principle of housing as civic building, as housing should first and foremost be generous and adaptable and robust, so that in the future it doesn't have to be housing, it could be offices, it could be a hotel, it could be a university, but you just have to build in these qualities of robustness and generosity to achieve that. So I sort of hoped that that consciousness of the importance of generosity and light and space and would change the industry. Unfortunately, I don't think it has. I don't think the kind of business model of high-density urban housing in the UK, for example, or even in North America, I don't think it changed, which is really unfortunate. In terms of space for dwellings, because the investment model is tied to sort of minimum standards and, you know, in theory, making homes affordable, so they have to be small. And the real estate industry or the property industry works according to minimum standards in the UK. The one area where I think we have made gains in terms of that experience is the principle of the sort of common spaces, the foyers, the kind of entrance spaces to housing. We have been promoting as co-work spaces. Again, before COVID, a long time before COVID, I was putting forward the principle that if people are working from home, you don't want to be in your apartment all day. Why have these ornamental foyer spaces that nobody uses, you know, with some sofas and some plants and some bad art? You know, the foyer could be a relief or a change from your apartment, and you can potentially meet your neighbors and start to form a kind of community hub by using the ground floor of housing buildings more effectively. So a lot of our projects, we've managed to do that, and everybody can relate now when you say, look, we all know that if you're working from home and you live in an apartment or a tall building, you really need choices of where to go and where to work, and rather than go to a cafe down the street, why not work in your own building? And then you might actually meet some people, make some friends, start to build a sense of a kind of collective home. So that has traction, I think. But in terms of a fundamental change to how the development industry sees urban housing, I don't think that's really changed. The institutions that have the power to change that are the planning authorities. So if it was embedded into planning guidelines, that, you know, space guidelines, that in light of what's happened with COVID and with potential future pandemics, we require as a city or as a borough greater space standards or more balconies or more outdoor space, then it would happen. But until it's legislated, it's not going to happen. It's the economics of development that didn't shift fundamentally.
Do you agree to say the apartments need to be smaller in the city because many people want to live in the city? We have to give space to everybody, not only richer people who can afford like 120 square meters when they live on their own. So do you agree that apartments have to be smaller and the community spaces have to be greater?
I think you need a diversity in terms of what you provide, and that includes everything from small 38 square meter flats to larger ones. But I think what makes a huge difference in terms of dwelling space is the ceiling height. You know, if you have a small flat that has high ceilings, it actually feels quite good. and you can think of innovative ways of storing everything in your life in a space that has higher ceilings and gets better light. And it's something that the Victorian architects, 19th century architects, understood, that high ceilings, even if you have small rooms, first of all, they let in natural light. More, you get more hours of daylight because they didn't have electricity. So if you have to work by candlelight, it's much better to have high ceilings with taller windows, and then you get more hours of daylight. And they're also a bit more civic, I would say, that when you have higher ceilings, they enable more people to be in one place at the same time and for it not to feel claustrophobic. I think the term and the concept of proportions was something that was eliminated or sort of banished from the language and the terminology of architecture with modernism, with the modern movement. Proportions were considered neoclassical or antiquated. And I think it was a huge loss in terms of one of the tools and the power of architecture, or for architects to be able to convey their ideas and the quality of work they're doing, and not be able to talk about proportions, because proportions, the relationship of elements to each other, you know, height, width, slenderness, you know, compositional strategies are often determined by how you deal with proportions. And it's such a loss that architects stop talking about it. But I think, again, now today, architects are starting to sort of reclaim terminology like proportions, like beauty, like generosity, and make the principle of well-being that everybody understands much more closely related to architectural space and architectural ideas. We can really affect people's well-being through our work. And yeah, that's our kind of job, in a way, is well-being fundamentally. We're not building buildings for the sake of buildings. Architecture is about enabling people to feel well about where they live and what they do, but also now including nature in that equation and ecology. How do we make architecture respond to nature and support nature and bring biodiversity back to cities, back to our everyday experience?
Architects cannot do that on their own. With who they should work together to achieve that?
I think you've raised a really good point, is that traditionally, architecture and ecology were two different disciplines. Either you were an ecologist or an ecological scientist or a botanist or a zoologist, or you were an architect. And there are two opposing ends of kind of contemporary or historic culture. But I think it's a sort of missing link. Mechanical and electrical environmental engineers have tried to fill the gap. But to be honest, they don't really study birds. A mechanical engineer doesn't study bird life or insect families or, you know, all of those kind of zoological considerations that we now need to remember when we design. So I think there's a missing link in the world of design and the built environment, which is about sort of architectural zoology.
Or, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sort of ecosystem design. And I think, you know, architects claim to be ecosystem designers, but they're not really, because they haven't had the education. Yeah, I think that's the future, bringing together these oppositional, or the way education, the sort of classical or the canon of sort of university courses and departments, and the way we've segregated different disciplines into their silos, they really need to come together. And this is something that we are actually dealing with when we are working on projects in Canada, for example. We're doing a major new project in Toronto, Quayside. And in Canada, the indigenous way of thinking about nature, the weather, the spirit world, the importance of reciprocity between nature and human culture is now very much at the forefront of everyone in Canada, in particular, in the development industry and across all of society. And I think there are incredible lessons to be learned from Indigenous, First Nation cultures and history in the way they saw nature as being part of human culture, not apart from it.
Yeah.
So we're learning a lot from those experiences, and obviously there's a huge amount of work to be done, but at least we're taking those steps. The acknowledgement of those cultures and those places, and trying to really change our way of thinking about how we work. And it affects everything. It's not just the projects that we're doing in Canada. And now I think that way when I'm looking at any project, it's sort of, how can this architecture give back to not only the street, to the local neighborhood, to the community, but how can it give back to nature? And this is, you know, the biodiversity net gain. That's the technological term, is, you know, what is the biodiverse net gain of your project? Which is, you know, it's a very scientific, rationalist way of measuring, you know, measuring things that are pretty unpredictable. So we really need to kind of see our work as being part of the life sciences and not just engineering and the technology of building.
Yeah, I've heard about a biologist also from North America, Gretchen Daly. She expresses the bees' work in numbers. What is it worth? How many billions of dollars? What they do each year? Because she says
incredible.
It's the only way we understand how important these animals are for us, these insects.
Yes, it's sort of numerical, you know, attributes, the value. We only value things by the economic output of that activity. So how do worms support the British economy? And somebody can actually do, you know, a calculation and figure out their worth, you know, £2 trillion to the British economy. And then everybody will start to really value worms.
Exactly.
But, you know, it is a more integrated and holistic way of thinking, and that's what we need to do. We have to take radical action to change our ways.
Yeah, but also we need to understand that we don't do the birds a favor when we allow them to use the building as well, but we do a favor for ourselves if we invite the nature, because we need the healthy nature for ourselves. No, I mean, it's not like we have to help others, we have to help ourselves at this point.
Yes, and we also can individually make a real difference just by the things we do as individuals. For example, you know, if you have a garden, just let it go wild. Rather than the, you know, the lawn, the grass lawn with a few trees, just seeding your garden with wildflower seeds and letting it grow wild. And the kind of increase in insect life and increase in bird life, just out of many, many small acts of change, you know, that's going to create the kind of mass shift in the equation between sort of nature and human culture.
Yeah. What is your vision for, let's say, London, because we're here now? What do you wish for yourself, for your profession, and for the city, how it will go on in the future?
London is a great place to live and work, but it suffers from a kind of dominance of the car still. There's still huge problems with traffic and, you know, car ownership and people driving alone in cars and driving into the city and causing air quality problems. So I think I really look forward to the future when cars are electric. That will help. And maybe roads are narrowed and they become a single surface, so it's a sort of shared environment between cyclists, pedestrians, cars, and they're quiet, quiet and pollution-free. We all are completely addicted to mobility. So I don't think there will be a future when there will be no cars. I think those vehicles will just be hopefully net zero in terms of their carbon, and they'll be quiet and they'll be safe. So something like what we all experienced during the first lockdown when the city was quiet, it was just such an amazing thing to hear birds and to hear the wind, and that was kind of a wonderful thing. There's a huge project of regeneration that is still happening in the UK. The kind of legacy of 1960s and 1970s, urban planning, housing estates that have generated pockets of deprivation, gang culture. You know, there are huge problems still with the kind of legacy of modernism, really, the modern project of sort of slum clearance and utopian housing schemes. And so I work very hard in housing projects in London to rebuild and often demolish. Unfortunately, a lot of those buildings suffer from really systemic problems that can't be corrected through refurbishment. So we rebuild and try to build in a way that creates great neighborhoods for people to live. I have sort of certain projects that I think about, like sort of reimagining the Thames, making the Thames as a waterway more accessible, more also more nature friendly, but also more usable, because it's like a channel of water that you don't, it doesn't really contribute to most people's quality of life in the city, and it's just a wonderful thread of kind of life and nature that runs through the city that's been kind of ignored, or there's so many barriers between people and the river. So there's a kind of project of reimagining the Thames, many things, and cultural buildings are quite rare now in the UK because there's not a lot of funding for things like libraries or you know, theaters. Those are quite rare, but obviously those buildings are wonderful to work on. And we're I'm actually doing one at the moment in Cambridge, and we're working on education, you know, major education buildings. London competing right now for the London School of Economics new building. Those are always wonderful projects to work on, but I keep those, that kind of work, in balance with the project of housing and of making really good pieces of city that benefit everybody. Because there's no, in my view, there's no more important building type for architects to deliver in terms of improving quality of life for all. So these are some of the ideas that I have about how to make London a better place to live, and hopefully it will be a greener place, that there will be in the future ways that we work that enable the kind of original landscape qualities and the original ecology of London, which has been totally transformed over 1,000 years, to start restoring that and bringing that back into our daily life.
Thank you very much for spending me time and answering my questions, Alison Brooks.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.